My name is Ed Goldberg, and I'm speaking with Blake Nelson. Blake, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
Now, you're a local boy, eh?
I am. I grew up in Beaverton, and I went to Jesuit High School.
We're here to talk about your book, Girl, and it's published by Simon Pulse Teen Fiction. That's basically Simon & Schuster's young adult version. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
This book is set in the 80s?
The early 90s.
Early 90s, okay. The narrator of the book is a young girl named Andrea Marr, who's about 16 when we first meet her.
Yes.
And we go past her 17th birthday into her senior year in high school.
Yes.
Well, the first question I'm going to ask about this is, it's set in and around Portland.
Uh-huh.
This book, I think, is a very honest, I mean, surprisingly honest assessment of what goes on in high school with kids. So the first question is, is it a little rough for teen fiction? I mean, there's sex and drug use in here, and yet this book has been published twice. This is a republication of the book.
Yeah, yeah.
So apparently they don't think it's as bad as I did, huh?
Well, there's an odd polarity going on in YA fiction or children's fiction. YA means young adult. And that is that they like it's kind of an exploding market thanks to Harry Potter and some of the other books like that, and so there's a lot of room in it that there didn't used to be. When I first published the book in 1994, it was too risque for YA fiction, which in 1994 was basically Sally's in a wheelchair, you know, Betsy has an eating disorder, or somebody lost their pony,
mm-hmm.
and. So, but because the market has gotten so big and there's so much room in it, it both reflects the sort of wholesomeness of the new teenagers, you know, that High School Musical mentality. There's a lot of chick litty books and a lot of princess books and a lot of fantasy books.
Yeah, but those are all for tweeners, really. I mean, they're not really for high school kids. Girls 8 to 12, basically. I mean, Hannah Montana. I doubt whether a junior in high school would even be caught dead with a Hannah Montana notebook.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So anyway, what I was saying is that then there's also some room on the other end now where you can kind of be a little more straightforward. One of the huge publishing successes of the last couple of years was The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, which it's not quite as explicit as my book, but it has, you know, it's a pretty good standard of what the median for sex and drugs is, and it's pretty honest and pretty straightforward. So,
well, I think that's true. You know, I'm pretty old, and I went to high school in the 50s, and I was thinking back to all the drama and all the stuff that went on in high school. You know, when you're being bathed in those hormones, everything carries its own weight of drama, and everything is the most important thing in the world in the moment that it happens. And it turns out that except for the fact that there's more temptations and really more dangers for a kid nowadays, and you know, even back in the 90s when you wrote this book, this is again remarkably insightful about what goes on in a teenager's mind.
Yeah, it did. It did very well when it first came out, and like I said, it was published as an adult book, and I had hoped when I wrote it, because I'd been like a punk rocker in Portland in the early 80s and even late 70s, exactly. And my intention when I wrote it was to talk to other, and I by then was like about 30 when I wrote it. So my intention then was to write it as a reminiscence of my childhood, that other people that were 30 would go, oh, I remember like being interested in punk rock. But what actually happened was, that part of my audience was very small, and all these teenage kids found it and started to read it and started to really like it. And because it had enough contemporary stuff, I set it in the 90s. It's not set in the 70s. I just kind of used my knowledge of scenes and music and stuff like that. And so it got this huge and kind of unexpected audience of actual teenagers, the kind of teenagers that don't read YA books, that read adult books and kind of keep their... And a lot of that was started because it was excerpted and Sassy, which was the hip teen magazine of the moment.
Lucky you.
Yeah, that was a huge break. In fact, the book probably never would have been published if I hadn't done that.
So listen, I really need to ask you this because I'm really impressed. You're writing about a 16-year-old girl.
Uh-huh.
And at the time, you were a 30-year-old man.
Yeah.
Now, we've all been teenagers, and most of us, you know, we kind of tend to compartmentalize that thing and not, it's like the ugly cesspool in the back of our minds. How the heck did you write I mean, I really don't know what goes on in a teenage girl's mind, but if I had to guess, I would say this is a remarkably close map of what they worry about and what they think about. How did you put yourself in that mentality?
I don't know. That's the weird mystery that you can't ever explain. And I guess that's, you know, when people say if you have talent or not, I think that's the thing, that the sort of undefinable. I don't know why I know what teenage girls think. Well, but somehow I do, and I don't know. And like, I've written adult novels about adults, and people don't respond to them anywhere near. So it seems to be a specialized knowledge. It's not that I'm so wise that I know what everybody thinks. I just seem to have an odd ability to grasp that particular thing.
I'm really impressed with it.
And it's a little specific to girls, even. Like, my books about teenage boys, everybody likes them, but they don't sell nearly as well, and they don't grab people in the same way. And it's just one of those odd things. I'm a fairly normal person. I'm not like a pervert.
Well, you look like an accountant.
I'm not interested in teenage girls anything
sex
really.
Sex objects. Yeah,
I just think of them as, I find them very interesting because I think that that's such an huge and it's just such an interesting time in your life, especially for girls. I think there's a little more pressure on them in their teen years because I think they have a power then. A teenage boy is just expected to be an idiot. Like, nobody expects anything of a teenage boy.
And we usually do that quite well.
And they do it quite well. Yeah. But a 17-year-old girl has a certain magic to her, and there's a certain, it's no accident that in the Middle Ages they would, you know, marry people off when they were teenagers, because that's kind of at the moment when like their essence kind of emerges or something.
Well, it's also true that you could die at the age of 40.
And then
in
those
days.
Right, you could also die at the age of 40.
Everything was pushed back to But I want to hasten to tell people listening to this interview that there is nothing in this book that stinks of pedophilia or smarminess.
Yeah.
This is an uncritical examination of what goes on in high school, and I think, you know, it's terrific. Let's talk about the book a little bit. Andrea, we start out with one of those dramatic incidents that it seems much more important when you're a teenager than it would to anybody else, but there's a friend of hers named Sybil who isn't even her best friend. Darcy's her best friend at the time, although that changes.
Yeah.
Who calls up in hysterics and says she shaved her head. So Andrea, being a girl who's very compassionate, goes over and tries to help her through this crisis. Why did Sybil shave her head?
Sybil shaves her head because she's met they're girls from the suburbs, and they're not particularly hip or whatever. And Sybil is downtown, and she meets this extraordinary musician who somehow gives her the idea that that her life is very limited and she needs to break out. And so Sybil, on an impulse, shaves her head, which is something people did in 94 as an act of rebellion, like Sinead O'Connor or something.
Exactly.
Like that. I can't imagine a girl with a shaved head now, which shows that is a pretty extreme fashion statement. But so she doesn't really know why she shaved her head. She just knows that she wants something more. And then as the book proceeds, Sybil ends up in a really good band and ends up being kind of a leader of the whole movement of teenagers as they sort of break out of their suburban existence.
Now, I used to be a rock critic, and I've been a music fan, you know, like I bought my first rock and roll record in 1954, so I've been listening to this stuff for a long time. The evolution of the band name was one of the funniest little things in the book. It's a throwaway, really, but the band starts out as the Thrift Store Apocalypse and winds up as Sins of Our Fathers and goes through several iterations in between, and all of them are absolutely believable as band names.
Yeah,
good job on that.
Todd Sparrow
starts out as a distant, almost Christ-like figure, and you see him from a distance and you wonder, could I ever get to be friends with Todd Sparrow? Well, it turns out that Andrea does become quite close to Todd Sparrow, and in many ways he's just a guy, right?
He's the guy that Sybil meets downtown, and And he's just a symbol of, I remember being in high school and I was in like bands and I was kind of trying to learn how to play and be a musician. And you'd hear about these people, their names would get to you first. It was sort of before the internet. But you'd be hanging around at the music store, you'd be hanging around at the all ages club, and you'd hear some name like Todd Sparrow. And in fact, there was a guy running around in my day called Todd Souvenir. And I actually used his name at first and then I had to change it, of course. But he had one of those, you know, it had an interesting name. He was in a band. And you kind of heard, oh, there's this guy, Todd Sparrow. He's, you know, watch out for him. He's a great, you know, he's trying to form a band. And you'd see him and he'd have some outlandish haircut or something. And you'd, you know, and as a high school student, you're just in awe of anybody that would dare do anything. And especially someone who would dare to have a band or try to be creative. And that's what the whole book is about, really. It's about, like, these girls learning that, you know, learning that they don't have to just sit out there in the suburbs, that they can, like, Sybil starts a band, Andrea has her own, you know, she kind of starts to write for the paper and starts to expand out into other things, and they have great adventures and they kind of find each other. And like all, you know, all good books about teenagers all have to have that element of stepping out into the world and kind of like sort of absorbing the whole universe in one sort of moment. And there's a great scene where she's gone off to, where Andrea goes to Seattle to see Sybil, who's now in a real band and has gotten signed to a record label. And as she's coming home, she absorbs the whole totality of this whole experience. And she calls her dad from a payphone, and it's raining, and it's kind of this cool scene. And the poor, you know, and she just expresses to her dad, like, oh, my God, you know, I'm kind of a grown-up now. I've kind of seen what can happen in the world. And it's a great moment. It's one of my best, you know, it's my great first novel.
This is your first novel?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, good job on a first novel. I want to talk a little bit about Andrea's world, the stuff that happens every day, you know, the minutiae of a kid's life when they're in high school. First of all, she's into retro clothing. She hangs out in used clothing shops. Talk a little bit about that.
I think that's still in fashion. I think
Absolutely.
People still do that. And I don't know, maybe they did that before, but it seems...
60s.
In the 60s,
that's
I
when
guess.
We started going through thrift shops and wearing clothing from other generations.
Right, right.
Costumes,
so, yes,
really.
So it's not a new thing.
We thought of them as costumes, and I don't think kids do anymore. They think them as clothing.
Clothes, yeah. It's an interesting thing. I just know that was a big thing for me in high school. I remember like going and buying my first, I think the Blues Brothers movie had come out, and me and my buddies all went down to the thrift store and we bought like coats as opposed to whatever we normally wore. And I felt like that was kind of another moment of breaking out. And, you know, it's just a fun thing to talk about. And I lived in Portland at the time that I wrote the book. And I myself was going to all those thrift stores. So it was just a lot of fun to, like, reference them and talk about them. And I think for girls especially, like, the moment when you, you know, it was a fun line that people always repeat back to me, which is, she says, if you throw away all your uncool clothes, then you have to wear cool clothes, and then you become a cool person.
That's right, yes. Well, because clothing makes the person, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. And I remember doing that at one point in college, I think it was. I literally just threw all my jeans away. I threw all my, I threw anything that wasn't some sort of interesting statement away, forcing me to be, like, the most interesting person that I could
Aren't
be.
You sorry you got rid of all those Black Sabbath t-shirts now, though?
Yeah. Well, of course, the jeans are probably, you know, worth millions, but...
Certainly in Japan, yeah. Scamps. I love the idea that they go to Scamps. I mean, you don't really spend too much telling us about that place, but it's a place where you go have frozen yogurt. So whatever else is going on, these girls go to what's in effect an ice cream parlor and sit around and eat ice cream.
Yeah. I remember that from my band days. Like, no matter how cool of a band you were, you still like had some weird thing that you liked. Like the cool, yeah, you know,
kids.
Like if REM would come by, they no matter what, they still wanted to go to Dunkin' Donuts because somebody liked the one kind of donut. So I liked the mundanity of something.
Yeah, but you know, they're also children. I mean, the thing that reminds us of the children is that they have, they do things that kids do.
Yeah.
I'd like to remind our listeners, I'm speaking with Blake Nelson. Blake is the author of Girl, published by Simon Pulse Teen Fiction, but it's more or less an adult book. I didn't have any trouble. I didn't know it was teen fiction until after I finished it and I said, teen fiction.
I've been doing lots of YA books, and they're all like that. And I'm lucky that the children's book world is letting me do it, because they're not really teen books. Like they're books about teen. They're adult books about teenagers, and they've just let me keep doing it. So I just keep doing it. But they're very genre bending, and I hope at some point. You know, maybe I'm, you know, helping to bend the boundaries of it or something.
Well, as I was reading this book, I was thinking that if I don't have any kids, but if I were a father with a 10-year-old girl and I read this book, I would think two things, chastity belt and bars on the windows. because Andrea, like a lot of girls her age, finds virginity a burden. And she wants to get rid of it just because it seems like losing 20 pounds or something. It's just, you know, it's something she wants to do because she knows she'll be better on the other side. But she try as she may for a while, she can't seem to get that job done. And then finally, after she does get that job done, sex becomes just something else to do, like listening to music or going for frozen yogurt.
Yeah. I don't, you know, I think that every kid is different. I know my own personal situation was I lost my virginity to my, like, high school sweetheart who I had been in love with for years and years and years, and it was very special. But I know that most people kind of lose their virginity at a party or...
in the backseat of a car.
In the backseat of a car or, you know, or with a boyfriend or girlfriend, which is, you know, the preferable way, I suppose. And... So, but I think, you know, kids, you know, they know what's up, and they're physically sexual beings. So I think that it's a pretty honest, you know, you want sex to be special for people, but I think a lot of teenagers, see it that way, and they see it as, you know, I hear stuff all the time, and you hear these little rumors go through the children's book world. There was a book called Rainbow Party that was about how teenage girls all have oral sex now, and everybody gets all excited, and it's on Oprah, and everybody freaks out. But I think people forget that when you're a teenager, a lot of stuff gets said, and not nearly as much gets actually done. It's mostly talk. It's locker room talk, and it's not, you know, and of course they're thinking about it. You know, they're, like you said, drenched in hormones. But I don't think, you know, I think it's a natural thing. I don't think, you know, I don't think, I think how it ends up for her is pretty typical, and she has a good heart, and, you know, people make their own way in the sexual realm.
Yeah, she. The thing that I found interesting about it is that when I was going to high school, back, you know, when dinosaurs ruled the earth, the idea was to do it with someone you loved. And now the idea seems to be to do it with someone you like or just someone you think is hot. And love doesn't seem to enter into it that much. Am I right about that?
I think that their capacity for romantic love is so far beyond our capacity for romantic love as, like, people that are over 30, say, that I think that they just don't ever let us see that. I think that they love intensely, and I think that they... I think that they keep that away from us. We don't know. We don't know what they really think. I was so deeply in love with this girl that I was my high school sweetheart. I can't even imagine the depths of it. Like, I could never have told my parents or explained to them how I felt about her. And I think that's a common thing that happens.
Yeah, the puppy love is something that adults like to
make fun of. Yeah,
well, not just make fun of, but it's something that makes them feel better about what their kids are doing.
Right,
thinking, oh, it's just puppy love; it's not serious. Little do they know what's really going on. But while they're at work, but that I think the puppy love fiction is something that helps adults get through the day.
Yeah.
If they have teenage children.
Yeah, and also I think that there's a disappointment as you get older; you don't feel that strong of emotion. You know, like your wife or whatever you love.
Thank heaven.
In a totally different way, you know.
Yeah.
It's a much lower level of things. And I think at that moment, when you're capable of that spectacular of an emotion, when you're 14 or 15, which I think is when you're really the most primed for it, I think girls especially, a 15-year-old girl can love in a way that nobody else even can grasp. And so, I think some of the, You know, and I think, and to have that combined with their awakening into sexual things really is a, you know, to parents, a dangerous mix. But for kids, a great moment in their life when epic, you know, when great, you know, they're never going to forget that guy they loved when they were 15. They, mm-hmm. you know, they can't remember the guy they met in the club, like when they're 30, but...
Well, in their 30, they're still meeting guys in clubs.
They're still, yeah, unfortunately for them, yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about that, the scene. Now, I've been living in Portland since 91. Before that, I lived in Washington, D.C., but I went through the whole punk rock thing, and I was 10 years older than everybody else in that, but I remember the 16, 17, 18-year-old girls coming to the clubs to hear the local bands and coming to the clubs to hear the touring bands. You know, if the Dead Boys came to town, they were there,
If
the local band, the Slicky Boys, were there, they were there also. So, and you described this magnificently, because these kids all go to see, to be seen. A lot of them are into the music, but in some ways, the music is secondary to seeing and being seen.
Yeah, yeah, it's the scene phenomenon, and I think I just was watching the Hard Day's Night by the Beatles movie just last night. I was watching it, and I don't think that changes that much. You know, like the styles change, but there's always a little pocket of intense, fashionable, musical, whatever, avant-garde.
Frank Sinatra and the Bobby Soxers.
Frank Sinatra and the Bobby Soxers, and I just think that's such an exciting, fun moment in a kid's life. To when if you even just brush up against it, you don't even necessarily have to be part of it.
I think everybody remembers the first rock concert they ever went to.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And fondly.
Yeah, yeah. But these scenes are much more interesting than a rock concert. I went to like an Aerosmith concert at the Coliseum when I was 15. And
the club stuff is the best stuff.
Yeah, it's that thing you said of seeing and being seen. And, oh, there's that girl with the red hair that I saw last week, and maybe I can talk to her this week, and all that stuff. That's really the fun stuff.
And then there's the phenomenon of getting in tight with the musicians. You know, not even necessarily sexually. It's just the idea that your status among your peers is raised amazingly if you're seen talking to the bass player in the band.
Right. And you align yourself aesthetically. Like if you're like a Minor Threat kind of guy, you know, then you hang out.
Oh, you know the DC bands,
sure,
do you?
Sure, yeah, okay. And if you're, when I was in college, there was Echo and the Bunnymen and The Cure, and there was those guys.
Psychedelic
and they were sort
furs.
Of the romantic, yep, they were sort of the British romantic guys. At the same time, there was Black Flag, Minor Threat, and those American guys. So it was kind of fun to align yourself with those different, you know, the different aesthetics and the different moods that each one had. You know, you like the punk rock girl, or do you like the new romantic girl? So all that stuff's really fun.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know much about emo, but it seems to me that if you align yourself with that, it says something about you that doesn't say it if you go into the hardcore bands, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And your aesthetics change. And that's one of the things that I liked about this book is that the focus of Sybil's band, as not only does it change names, but it changes attitudes and it changes what they're trying to do. In fact, a lot of the book is talks about how they're casting about for a sound or an idea that's a little different from everybody else.
Yeah.
And they add a couple of semi-professional musicians at the end, including the bass player Fiona, who is kind of a fascinating character.
Oh, yeah.
And they're really striving for something.
Yeah, yeah. Sybil's really ambitious. And that's, that made the whole book, is her, the arc of her. Even though, like you say, she isn't really... Andrea's best friend, her drive and her ambition really wakes Andrea up to what's possible in the world and how to get things done, you know. And I think that's another one of those important things you pick up when you're a teenager. You look around at the people around you and you notice who's doing what and how they do it, and that's when you get your first, you know. I was in bands all through my 20s, and I learned everything I did was based on like watching, like when I was in high school, watching like the local bands, what they had done, you know. Well, that guy wasn't afraid of anybody. He just went right up to the club owner and said, you know, we have to play at your club. And everybody hated that guy, you know. And like, and so when I had my chance, I imitated the guys that I saw go before me.
What's next? What are you doing next?
Well, I just, my book Paranoid Park just came out, and that's about skateboarders. And then the big news on that is the Gus Van Sant movie, which will be released here in Portland on March 14th at Cinema 21.
And it's also going to be at the Portland International Film Festival
at the
Northwest
Portland
Film Center. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And I hope this gets on before that goes on, but we'll certainly review your film.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you get to work with Gus?
We didn't work on the screenplay so much, but we I got to go to the set and kind of hang around with the guys. I didn't impose my, you know, I had been a long time Gus fan and I like all his movies, so I was just quite happy to sort of sit back and watch him work or whatever.
Yeah, he's another guy that seems to understand a little about what, you know, the teenage angst. And,
yeah, yeah.
And that it never really goes away. You just kind of suppress it.
Yeah, yeah. So it was, yeah, it was really fun to see his take on it. And it was just a lot of fun and real exciting.
I'll give you an idea free of charge. How's that?
Yeah.
I've noticed with friends of mine who stayed married for 20 or 25 years and suddenly they're in their 40s and they're divorced. And the only dating idea that they have to fall back on is what went on when they were 18, 19, 20 years old back in high school.
Yeah.
So what you have are mature adults behaving like high school kids.
Yep. Yep.
So you can have that idea free of charge. It seems to be the right guy to do it because, you know, as soon as that monster comes out of the back of your head, you know, there you are again in high school, you know, and you got zits on your soul. So
yeah. Well, maybe you're a little more honest. I think about that sometimes. Like maybe you're a little more, you're not as scared. I don't know. It's a little easier.
It's really been delightful talking to you. I've been speaking with Blake Nelson. Blake is a local guy, the author of Girl, published by Simon & Schuster, Simon Pulse Teen Fiction. Come back again.
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you so much.